So, Ms. Monday, on your to-do list this morning was the first thing, don't forget your notes.
Yes, Your Honor. I want to thank first the court and clerks and my opposing counsel and counsel in the first case for the consideration that they showed me this morning. A few minutes before the argument, I realized that I had left my argument notes in the hotel room. I will tell the court candidly, I have had this nightmare many, many times, but it had never happened before until this morning. So thank you very much, and I apologize for disrupting the court's schedule.
Restart the clock, please. Yeah.
Counsel, if I may, may I whisper to the Chief Justice that when you and Mr. Friedman argue against each other, it's among the very best that we ever receive, and this is one reason why. The courtesy that was shown.
It was deeply appreciated. Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Monica Monday, and together with my co-counsel, Scott Stevenson, we represent Charles Scott, who is the administrator of his wife's estate. Her name was Scarlett Scott. The issues in this medical malpractice case concern mitigation of damages. Ms. Scott was seen by two healthcare providers over a very short period of time for a severe headache. She was first seen in the emergency room by Dr. Moore, and 2 days later, she sought treatment from the defendant in this case, physician's assistant Foster. Both providers diagnosed her with a tension headache, which is a non-life-threatening condition, and both gave her injections to relieve her pain. When she was released from the care of Mr. Foster, he sent her home with instructions to rest and to return if her condition got worse, and also prescribed her a one-week course of treatment of Robaxin. She went home, she rested, she took the medication that was prescribed. She also took over-the-counter medications, but 1 week later, her brain aneurysm ruptured. The trial court instructed the jury on mitigation of damages and permitted the jury to find that Ms. Scott failed to mitigate her death from an undiagnosed brain aneurysm because she did not return to see a physician for the third time. We believe that this third time's a charm instruction was inappropriate. Jury instructions are only appropriate if they correctly state the law, if they are not confusing, and if they are supported by more than a scintilla of evidence. This instruction failed on all counts. It was confusing, it was in essence a contrived instruction, and it was not supported by more than a scintilla of evidence.
Why was it in essence a contrived instruction? I mean, there were damages that would have been recoverable prior to the mitigation instruction kicking in. And the verdict was on liability.
So Your Honor, let me address the second question first, which is the question about couldn't the jury have awarded lesser damages other than death? The answer is no, and it is found on Joint Appendix page 70. It is Jury Instruction 19. This was the damages instruction that was given to the jury, and it enumerated the damages that could be awarded in this case. And the court will see that nowhere does it permit the jury to award damages for example, the treatment that Mr. Foster provided. Rather, it says the expenses for the care, treatment, and hospitalizations of Ms. Scott incident to the ruptured aneurysm resulting in her death.
But did you object to the instruction not permitting damages prior to that point?
We did not, Your Honor, but the point is that this is the law of the case, and it only permitted the jury to award damages that subsequent incident to the rupture. The rupture did not occur until a week after the treatment.
I follow that, but I'm struggling as to how that helps you. Because if for some reason you didn't claim the damages that preexisted at that point in time, that's not the defense fault.
Your Honor, the argument that is made goes to the question of whether or not the giving of the instruction was harmful or not. And the defense says, well, they could have awarded fewer damages. We believe that this shows that they didn't. Now, let me address the jury instruction. There are two reasons why. Well, an instruction is presumed to be prejudicial unless it is affirmatively shown by the record it's not.
Can I jump in for a second? Because
yes, sure.
That's part of your answer I didn't understand. Because I thought what they were trying to show was, say, for instance, in this particular instance, Ms. Scott, when she went to the hospital, she had a craniotomy. They took off part of her skull, et cetera, and they said that cost over $200,000 to be done. For that to be done, and I thought they were trying to show in mitigation that if she had gone to an emergency room after her visit with Mr. Foster, she could have had like a $60,000 procedure, which would have helped her.
Correct, Your Honor. But again, the point is, this instruction number 19, does not permit the awarding of any damages before it ruptured. So by the time it ruptures, you're at the hospital where you're having the more elaborate procedure done. But turning to, there are two reasons
why. But the verdict was not liability with zero damages. The verdict was no liability.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's the point that I'd like to move to, is the argument that this was harmless because the jury rendered a verdict for the defendants. There are two reasons why we believe that is incorrect. And first rests with the jury instruction, with the verdict form itself. And the verdict form did not provide a space for the jury to say that the defendant was negligent, and it certainly did not provide a space for the jury to say, we find that the plaintiff failed to mitigate the damages. Rather, on Joint Appendix page 72, it shows that the verdict form merely said, we, the jury on the issues joined, find in favor of the defendants and against Mr. Scott. Now, why does this matter? It matters because, given this form, the jurors could have found that the defendants were negligent, but also that the plaintiff failed to mitigate her damages, and would have entered the very same verdict. So we disagree that the verdict form provides an absolute answer to the harmless error question.
But would the verdict form be in isolation versus in totality with the remainder of the instructions that were given about liability, et cetera?
Well, I mean, clearly the instructions would be the law of the case, Your Honor. They would inform the jury, they would provide the law of the case, but the verdict itself, I think the argument that the defendants are making is, we have a defense verdict. Our point is, that defense verdict may not be as reliable as we think for the issue that we're looking at here. The second argument that we have deals with the language of the instruction itself, which we believe sounds like a contrib instruction and is also confusing. And what happened here was, is that the defendants took what is the model jury instruction on mitigation of damages and added language in two parts, including death. This, on the facts of this case, I'm not saying in every single case that you might have, in the facts of this case, that permitted the jury to find that the plaintiff's failure to exercise ordinary care, language in the instruction,
I apologize
would bar
for
recovery
for
her death.
May I circle back very briefly
yes,
to the first point? The jury form we're looking at, page 72, right?
Yes, John.
I mean, it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for every beneficiary, a dollar figure. And as you know, we see $0 verdicts in liability cases not that infrequently. So, I mean, they did have that option. They could have said, you know what, he was negligent, but we don't find any damages, and fill in 000 or whatever. That's very different from saying, I find for the defendant, which is a liability expression.
Your Honor, and perhaps I could pick up on what I think Justice McCullough was saying, which is that needs to be read in conjunction with this instruction number 19, which I believe reads to say the expenses for care and treatment that she could get were those for the rupture, which occurred, obviously.
Which would mean zero. I mean, under your logic, it would be the mitigation, the de facto contrib instruction would have kicked out every liability after that. But the logical response would be, he is liable, but there's zero damages because they didn't claim damages prior to the mitigation event.
But I don't read these the same way, Your Honor. I think that given instruction number 19, they could not have awarded a lesser amount on this record, given the law of the case and the instructions. But we also need to look too at the actual instruction itself, and that goes to Your Honor's other question concerning why does this sound like a contrib instruction. The language in the instruction actually uses ordinary care. And when you add the language that death was the sole source of recovery in this case, that's what all the instructions say, that her death is the sole source of recovery. And again, instruction number 19. When read with that, this permits the jury to say if she failed to exercise ordinary care for her health, it's a complete bar. We also think that the instruction is quite confusing. I have trouble reading it. I'm not sure what it means, and I think that a jury would have trouble understanding how death would be an aggravation of an injury. So
okay,
by tinkering with this model,
so
yes,
Your Honor. Let me ask you this. If the words including death had not been added, so in other words, if you were dealing with instruction 35.110 modified only for physician assistant, would you be making the same argument? Is your argument that the model jury instruction is problematic, or only that this is problematic?
Your Honor, I'm on the Model Jury Instruction Committee, so I will say that I did have some heartburn when I looked at the actual instruction itself in the context of this case. I will say that I did have some concerns with it. I think that, however, when you add the including death, given the facts of this case, it becomes extremely problematic. And it does read like a contrib instruction. We're talking about ordinary care.
Well, think about this from the defense point of view. If I'm understanding you, and correct me if I'm not, it means that the defendant can never raise a mitigation of damages defense in a case where the plaintiff is only arguing for damages after the mitigation event, because that would translate it into a contrib defense, which it isn't, obviously. Right? What's wrong with that logic?
No, Your Honor, and I'm not sure that I understand your question.
Let me repeat it. If what you're saying is they could not have awarded pre-mitigation damages because you didn't ask for it, the jury instruction didn't ask for it, et cetera. They can only award post-mitigation event damages. Therefore, and this is the non sequitur I'm perceiving, therefore it must be a contrib instruction because you end up with zero. That means, if that were true, no defendant could come into any case, a tort case of any kind, and say, I want a mitigation damage instruction. You can't have it, Ms. Kelsey. Well, why? Because the only thing they're asking for is damages after mitigation. That makes you seeking contrib. And I would say, no, I'm not seeking contrib. I may be liable, but they have no damages.
Well, and Your Honor, I don't think that would apply in our case, given what happened. Nor do I think that I don't think the instruction would have been appropriate in the scenario that you provided.
So they lose their mitigation defense because of the way the plaintiff pleads the damage case. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, and maybe it would be helpful for me to turn to what was the source of the duty to mitigate in this case, which was the discharge instructions themselves. And this goes to our assignment of error dealing with whether there was more than a scintilla of evidence to support it.
May I ask a question about 16 before
yes,
we
Justice.
Move on? Because it has the wording to avoid loss, why doesn't it make it a mitigation instruction and not a contrib instruction, as you are arguing? You use ordinary care to avoid loss or to minimize the damages.
Your Honor, I do agree that it is possible for a jury to read this as a mitigation instruction, but I think that for the reasons I've already stated, it is also probably probable that a jury read it as a contrib instruction. Obviously there is language in here, as Your Honor points out, that is more in the nature of mitigation language, but given the way this reads, given the death language, and given that it references ordinary care in the context of this case, it reads more like a contrib instruction. So I think the question is, could this have confused the jury? And the answer is yes. Now, turning to the question of whether
But if we're not sure it did or didn't, then it's an abuse of discretion, bell-shaped curve, and that covers the trial judge.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because under the harmless error analysis, the question is whether the record affirmatively shows that it did not.
No, abuse of discretion would make it no error at all. You wouldn't even get to harmlessness under that analysis. It would be no error at all because it's a reasonable interpretation of the instruction and it's not plainly misleading.
Under the harmless error analysis, Your Honor, if this was potentially confusing to the jury and we cannot tell for sure whether it did confuse the jury, then it must be deemed harmful. With Your Honor's permission, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman. Matthew Kelly's with me at counsel's table. I'd just like to point out before I deal with the issues I had started to plan to go on, JA 505. This is the exhibit that the plaintiff sent to the jury, and it includes all kinds of damages, including the $130 charge from Mr. Foster's place. They sent this in and they asked for damages. And they asked for $2 million in damages, but they gave them things that occurred well before. I don't know if they're now arguing without objecting to Instruction 19 that incident means, oh, we're not asking for anything we actually asked for. But they did ask for them. Having said that, this case involves whether or not physician's assistant Foster adhered to the standard of care. And it was a classic jury question as to liability. And the defense experts provided a step-by-step analysis that what he did met that standard. And frankly, plaintiff's experts basically said if he had thrown a battery of tests on the patient, they might have found an aneurysm. Now, here's the problem. Mr. Foster works at an intermediate care center. There is no CT scanner, and it's not affiliated with Central Hospital. He could send her to Central Hospital. They say he should have ordered one. You know, he can send her to Central Hospital, but he can't force them to give her a CT scan. He sees her for a snapshot in time, one maybe a little under an hour. And what does he do? He does everything he should do. He checks the ER report from 2 days before, where the emergency room with a CT scanner didn't give a CT scan, because it's not something loosely done. It's got a lot of radiation. It's not something you just do willy-nilly. He talks to her. He gives her a physical exam. He provides meds, and at the end of that meeting, she's much better. In about 15 minutes.
But it's not really necessary to persuade us. The question is, did you persuade the jury, and is it clear that they made a finding that you persuaded the jury on liability?
Well, and that is my point, I guess, cutting to the chase. You know, she's down to a level 5. He says, if it gets worse, go to the ED. We have expert who say that meets the standard of care. We had a very strong liability case. So the case, in fact, on the instructions in the verdict form, confirmed that this was a liability verdict. Instruction 11A and instruction 9A, JAs 58 and 60, they direct the jury to find your verdict for the plaintiff if plaintiff proved that Foster was negligent and that Foster's negligence was the proximate cause of Mr. Scott's death. They didn't find that. The jury signed a defense verdict at JA 72, at JA 490. Not a plaintiff's verdict with a zero recovery, not a plaintiff's verdict with $130. They signed, we find for the defendant. The mitigation instruction, 16A, JA 65, limits any duty to mitigation to a patient who is injured as a result of a physician assistant's negligence. So you don't even get to mitigation without underlying negligence. There's no duty of that. Now, the jury did not ultimately reach or apply mitigation, but if they had, the instruction here is consistent with Virginia law. It's consistent with Sawyer, Holly, Monahan, Lawrence. Mitigation is allowed in a medical malpractice setting, even in a wrongful death setting, as long as the evidence supports it. So let's look at what that evidence is. Here, credible evidence supports.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question you're entitled to a mitigation instruction. The question is, was this instruction misleading or confusing? And so, you know, there are these tweaks to the model and the argument that maybe the model itself might be in need of some attention.
Okay. Well, with the preface to that being that what was said earlier, that there is clear evidence here about the clipping and the cord.
Yeah, I don't think there's no dispute in my mind that you are entitled to seek a mitigation instruction and go that route.
So, having you know, reached that point where it is clear it was supported, then you look at the instruction, 16A, page 65 of the appendix, and it says the mitigation of damages instruction, first, it only applies if you found negligence. So they didn't. If you assume they followed the instructions and you assume the verdict form, which wasn't objected to, says what it means, they didn't apply the mitigation instruction. But it properly informed the jury of Ms. Scott's duty to minimize any damages caused by the defendant's negligence. And that, again, gets back to the clipping and coiling. There's a lot of money involved. But the language of the instruction required the jurors to to award damages attributable to the initial negligence. It doesn't say wipe it all out. It just doesn't. And then it says, and mitigation is only denied damages for any aggravation or increase in injuries related to plaintiff's failure to use ordinary care. So basically, what you have is it wasn't applied, but even if plaintiff had objected, and plaintiff did object to the granting of any mitigation instruction, what they said after that was they proposed edits to this objection. And a lot of things in the brief about you didn't say, hey, this isn't a complete bar, which we think is clear from the rest of the instructions, but they didn't ask for that. What they asked for was an edit that said take out including death. And even if that's deemed an objection, it's not a substantial change. It's not a meaningful change. What does it do? If you take out including death and look at JA-65, it says any injuries. Well, any injuries under Virginia law, any means all. And it's the same. It's clarifying, but it's not changing dramatically.
Death is a fatal injury.
It could be. It doesn't have to be. But it's any injury. So the request they're asking for is, you know, an attempt to find fault with the instruction, but not really a meaningful one. Plaintiff contends that Foster's discharge instruction, if gets worse, go to the ED, didn't justify a mitigation instruction on the theory that her headache never got worse. I want to touch on that briefly just to deal with the marijuana use issue. You know, plaintiff's witnesses did contend that the headache stayed the same all week, but this testimony was disputed, and it was also a reversal of their prior deposition testimony. But at any rate, there was evidence that Ms. Scott's condition, her headache, did get worse after her discharge. She redeveloped photophobia. She couldn't even talk on the phone. In fact, one of her experts, Baumgartner, conceded that she got worse at JA-182-83. Nonetheless, plaintiffs stressed the idea that the headache stayed the same throughout, and that made the self-medicating and the marijuana issue relevant as to mitigation. As to the marijuana use and the medication use after July 21st, this evidence was introduced about as delicately as it possibly could be, but it was highly probative of the fact that after July 21st, Ms. Scott is not dealing with a 5 out of 10 headache anymore. And that's critical to mitigation. We already accepted that we need evidence of that. But the logic was the instruction, which the experts said for us said was okay, is if gets worse, go to the ED. They say it didn't get worse. The only way that there can be an obligation to go to the ED, which she didn't do, is if it gets worse. So we needed to prove that it gets worse. And at the time she was told to go to the ED again, she's a level 5. He thinks she's getting better, and she got better before, but he wants her to go to the ED if it comes back. Now let's remember, he can't give her a CT. He can't give her a CT scan. She's got to go to the hospital to do that. So it's clear that this evidence that she was popping, you know, handfuls of Sudafed and smoking marijuana was purely not to diminish her personality. It was because she was in such pain. And that's relevant. That's JA-329-330. So that's relevant to the question of his mitigation problem. And the judge explained it very clearly that the probable value was greater than the prejudice.
But if you, counsel, if you look at the Sawyer case, which was a wrongful death case, and essentially the jury instruction that was proposed here tracks that, except that it includes the death language, right? mitigating damages for death does seem different to me than mitigating damages for other injuries that don't result in death.
It is not the same necessarily as in a case where, you know, you're talking about a broken leg. But the thing that makes this case unusual, and I grant you that, is that both sides were kind of relying on this Dr. Liu testimony. They say, hey, you are...
No, I'm talking about the bar issue, the legal issue of it being a bar. I mean...
Well, it can't be a bar. That goes back to the $130 and all the stuff, you know, the Lynchburg Hospital. They're asking for all those things. And if we're looking at what the court... You know, if we're assuming they followed the instructions, none of that, you know, would have happened. They've got a liability verdict here, is what you have to assume. Now, as for your, you know, the instruction does not prohibit them from awarding the earlier damages. I mean, it just doesn't. And there was no objection to number 19 that, oh, the stuff we're asking for, we're not allowed to get.
Right, but that language wasn't used in the Sawyer case.
Well, and that objection, again, we're back to the objection that was made. The objection, take out including death doesn't change the instruction. And they didn't offer the Sawyer instruction. Although I do think this instruction is correct. As opposing counsel said, it's what was given, and you were left with what was given and what objections were made. The objection that's made is, take out including death. But including death in a wrongful death case isn't wrong. Again, if you take it out, then it says any injuries.
It is a death case.
It is a death case.
Therefore, it should go in.
But any injuries means the same thing. So what they suggested wasn't a significant change.
Well, aren't we really saying by this instruction, if the jury believes that the patient failed to use ordinary care to follow the instructions of the physician, and her estate may not recover for her death, if by such care her death could have been avoided?
I don't think we are, because...
So what are you saying?
We're saying that in instructions...
Just because you listed other damages prior to death?
Well, that's not all. I mean, it says, if a patient fails to perform this duty, she may recover for the injuries, including death, caused by her physician's assistant's negligence. So we're not saying you can't get anything. We're saying she gets everything that she's entitled to, but not for the aggravation of any injuries.
Well, counsel, here's the problem. Here's one problem. I can see that there are potentially others. Let me parse the sentence again. If a patient fails to perform this duty, she may recover for the injuries caused by her physician's assistant's negligence, but not for the aggravation of any injuries or increase of damages. So there I'm reading 35.110, the physician assistant instead of physician. I understand that. That's fairly clear. So now let's include the phrase including death the first time, but not the second time. And I'm going to take out the injuries. If a patient fails to perform this duty, she may recover for the death caused by her physician assistant's negligence. Okay, I can understand that if the physician's assistant's negligence caused death, you're going to be able to recover for that. Let's keep continuing. But not for the aggravation of death or increase of damages resulting from her failure to use ordinary care. By putting any injuries, including death, that second time, it essentially is nonsensical or absurd. It becomes, I can't parse it and have it make sense.
Well, I think that it does make sense.
How can you have for the aggravation of death?
Well, it says the aggravation of any injuries.
Including
if she
death.
Could have recovered if, say hypothetically, and I realize I'm over time now, but if she had gone right up to the edge of August the 3rd after 4 days in the hospital and you know, had all these damages, and then she did something that took her life, you know, that she was able somehow to take a whole bottle of pills or something, you know, if she'd done something at that point, surely you would say that she's entitled to all the damages that led up to that. She's entitled to all the damages that she had applied until she breached her duty of mitigation. And that's why, and I will wind up, if you assume they follow the instructions, it's very easy for them to give money, give damages, but they didn't. It's a liability verdict, and it's plain on the face of page 72. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, let me address the preservation of error issue concerning this instruction. On Joint Appendix 477, we raised the issue challenging the language including death in the instruction, and we said if the court grants the instruction as drafted, it's basically suggesting that a failure to keep the damages from increasing would bar her recovery completely, like an assumption of the risk or a contrib defense, which they acknowledge they don't have here, and through this instruction would effectively bar Ms. Scott from a recovery if it's given in this form. So we plainly objected. We objected at the right time, and we gave the substance of the objection.
How do you answer the response that you just heard, that you actually asked for pre-mitigation damages, and it's in the exhibit, you requested it, notwithstanding the jury instruction, you're not objecting to the jury instruction, and you didn't get a zero verdict, you didn't get a $130 verdict?
That's correct, Your Honor. I would have to say that in light of the posture that we're in now on appeal, that the instruction number 19, would trump any of that, that we have to look at that. It's an unappealed jury instruction. It is the law of the case, and pursuant to that instruction, the jury was not entitled to give those damages, and I'm afraid I don't have a better answer than that, but I think that instruction is now the law of the case.
So your waiver of the objection to the instruction means you win the case?
No, Your Honor, we're not appealing that instruction. There's no issue on appeal challenging that instruction at all. The only instruction that we appealed was the mitigation instruction. Now, I will point out that counsel started his argument by talking about the standard of care issues and how this was a hotly contested liability issue. That just increases the concern that we have with an instruction on mitigation that reads like a contrib instruction. And I would also point out that we should be concerned about mitigation instructions. They ought not to be a reflex that we have in a medical malpractice case where, this is not a contrib case, but you automatically get a mitigation instruction.
Well, let me ask you one last question. Why wouldn't death damages be precluded when there is, in fact, a mitigation breach? Why is that different, logically?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know.
Why are death damages precluded as a matter of law when there is, in fact, a mitigation event where the plaintiff fails to use reasonable care, like using the example of taking all the medication all at once and committing suicide and damages related to that? Why wouldn't the mitigation defense say yes, and we're not liable for those damages? We may be liable in terms of breach of duty of care, but we're not liable for the damages involving death.
I think, Your Honor, there certainly could be instances where that would be the case, but with an instruction that essentially invites the jury to find that there's an absolute bar to a case because of a failure to exercise ordinary care, that invitation to the jury rendered that instruction improper. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Call the next case.